Chapter 41. London. Catherine Blake left her flat shortly before 11 a.m., a light, cold rain falling. The darkening skies promised worse weather to come. She had 3 hours before her rendezvous with Neumann. On dreary days like these, she was tempted to skip her painstaking ritual sojourns across London and proceed straight to the rendezvous site. It was monotonous, exhausting work, constantly stopping and checking her tail, jumping on and off underground trains and in and out of taxicabs. But it was necessary, especially now. She paused in the door, knotting a scarf beneath her chin, looking into the street. A quiet Sunday morning, traffic light, shops still closed. Only the cafe across the street was open. A bald man sat in a window table, reading a newspaper. He looked up for an instant, turned a page, and looked down again. Outside the cafe, a half-dozen people waited for a bus. Catherine looked at the faces and thought she had seen one of them before, maybe at the bus stop, maybe somewhere else. She looked up at the flats across the street.
"If they're watching you, they'll do it from a fixed position, a flat or a room over a shop."
She scanned the windows, looking for any changes, any faces looking back at her. She saw nothing. She finished tying her scarf, put up her umbrella, and started walking through the rain. She caught her first bus in Cromwell Road. It was nearly empty. A pair of old ladies, an old man who mumbled to himself, a slight man who had shaved poorly, wore a soggy mackintosh, and read a newspaper. Catherine got off at Hyde Park Corner. The man with the newspaper did too. Catherine headed into the park. The man with the newspaper headed in the opposite direction, toward Piccadilly. What was it Fogel had said about the watchers of MI5?
"Men you would walk past on the street and never give a second look."
If Catherine was selecting men to be MI5 watchers, she would have chosen the man with the newspaper. She walked north on a footpath bordering Park Lane. At the northern edge of the park, at Bayswater Road, she turned around and walked back to Hyde Park Corner. Then she turned around and walked north again. She was confident no one was following her on foot. She walked a short distance along Bayswater Road. She stopped at a letterbox and dropped an empty, unmarked envelope into the slot, using the opportunity to check her tail once more. Nothing. The clouds thickened, the rain fell harder. She found a taxi and gave the driver an address in Stockwell. Catherine sat back in her seat, watching the rain running in patterns down the window. Crossing Battersea Bridge, the wind gusted, causing the taxi to shudder. The traffic was still very light. Catherine turned around and looked through the small porthole of a rear window. Behind them, perhaps 200 yards away, was a black van. She could see two people in the front seat. Catherine turned around and noticed the cabbie was watching her in his rearview mirror. Their eyes met briefly, then he returned his gaze to the road. Catherine instinctively reached inside her handbag and touched the grip of her stiletto. The cab turned into a street lined with bleak, identical Victorian houses. There was not another human being in sight, no traffic, no pedestrians on the pavement. Catherine turned around again. The black van was gone. She relaxed. She was especially anxious to make today's rendezvous. She wanted to know Fogel's response to her demand to be taken out of England. Part of her wished she had never sent it. She felt certain MI5 was closing in on her. She had made terrible mistakes. But at the same time, she was gathering remarkable intelligence from Peter Jordan's safe. Last night she photographed a document emblazoned with the sword and shield of Schaeff and stamped "Most Secret." It was quite possible she was stealing the secret of the invasion. She could not be sure from her vantage point. Peter Jordan's project was just one piece in a giant, complex puzzle. But in Berlin, where they were trying to fit that puzzle together, the information she was taking from Peter Jordan's safe might be invaluable, pure gold. She found she wanted to continue, but why? It was illogical, of course. She had never wanted to be a spy. She had been blackmailed into it by Fogel. She never felt any great allegiance to Germany. In fact, Catherine felt no allegiance to anything or anyone. She supposed that's what made her a good agent. There was something else. Fogel had always called it a game. Well, she was hooked on the game. She liked the challenge of the game, and she wanted to win the game. She didn't want to steal the secret of the invasion so Germany could win the war and the Nazis could rule Europe for 1,000 years. She wanted to steal the secret of the invasion to prove she was the best, better than all the bumbling idiots the Abwehr sent to England. She wanted to show Fogel that she could play his game better than he could. The taxi stopped. The cabbie turned around and said, "Are you sure this is the place?" She looked out the window. They had stopped along a row of bombed and deserted warehouses. The streets were deserted. If anyone was following her, they could not go undetected here. She paid off the driver and got out. The taxi drove away. A few seconds later, a black van approached, two men in the front seat. It drove past her and continued down the road. Stockwell Underground Station was just a short distance away. She threw up her umbrella against the rain, walked quickly to the station, and bought a ticket for Leicester Square. The train was about to leave as she reached the platform. She stepped through the doors before they could close and found a seat. Horst Neumann, standing in the doorway near Leicester Square, ate fish and chips from the newspaper wrapping. He finished the last bite of the fish and immediately felt sick. He spotted her entering the square amid a small knot of pedestrians. He crushed the oily newspaper, dropped it into a rubbish bin, and followed her. After a minute of walking, he pulled alongside her. Catherine looked straight ahead, as if she did not know Neumann was walking next to her. She reached out her hand and placed the film into his. He wordlessly gave her a small slip of paper. They separated. Neumann sat down on a bench in the square and watched her go. Alfred Vickery said, "Then what happened?"
"She went into Stockwell Underground Station," Harry said. "We sent a man into the station, but she had already boarded a train and left."
"Damn it," Vickery muttered.
"We put a man on the train at Waterloo and picked up her trail again."
"How long was she alone?"
"About 5 minutes.
Plenty of time to meet another agent."
"Afraid so, Alfred."
"Then what?"
"Usual routine. Ran the watchers all over the West End for about an hour and a half. She finally went into a cafe and gave us a break for half an hour. Then to Leicester Square. She made one pass across the square and headed back to World's Court."
"No contact with anyone?"
"None that we observed."
"What about on Leicester Square?"
"The watchers didn't see anything."
"The letterbox on Bayswater Road?"
"We confiscated the contents. We found an unmarked, empty envelope on top of the pile. It was just a ploy to check her tail."
"Damn it, but she's good. She's a pro."
Vickery made a church steeple of his fingers.
"I don't believe she's out there running around because she likes fresh air, Harry. She either made a dead drop somewhere or she met an agent."
"Must have been the train," Harry said.
"Could have been bloody anywhere," Vickery said. He thumped his arm on the side of the chair.
"Damn it!
We just have to keep following her. Eventually she'll make a mistake."
"I wouldn't count on that, Harry. And the longer we keep her under tight surveillance, the greater the chances are that she'll spot the tail. And if she spots the tail,
we're dead,"
Harry said, finishing Vickery's thought for him.
"That's right, Harry. We're dead."
Vickery tore down his church steeple to free his hands to smother a long yawn.
"Did you talk to Grace?"
"Yeah. She ran the names every way she could think of. She came up with nothing."
"What about Broom?"
"Same thing. It's not a code name for any operation or agent."
Harry looked at Vickery for a long moment.
"Would you like to explain to me, now, why you asked Grace to run those names?"
Vickery looked up and met Harry's gaze.
"If I did, you'd have me committed."
"It's nothing, just my eyes playing tricks on me."
Vickery looked at his wristwatch and yawned again. "I have to brief Boothby and collect the next batch of kettledrum material."
"We're moving forward, then?"
"Unless Boothby says otherwise, we're moving forward."
"What are you planning for tonight?"
Vickery struggled to his feet and pulled on his Macintosh.
"I thought some dinner and dancing at the 400 Club would be a nice change of pace. I'll need someone on the inside to keep an eye on them. Why don't you ask Grace to join you? Have a nice evening at the department's expense."
Chapter 42. Berchtesgaden.
"I'd feel better if those bastards were in front of us instead of behind us," Wilhelm Canaris said morosely,
as the staff Mercedes sped along the white concrete autobahn toward the tiny 16th-century village of Berchtesgaden. Fogel turned and glanced through the rear window. Behind them, in a second staff car, were Reichsführer Heinrich Himmler and Brigadeführer Walter Schellenberg. Fogel turned away and looked out his own window. Snow drifted gently over the picturesque village. In his foul mood, he thought it made the place look like a cheap postcard. Come to beautiful Berchtesgaden, home of the Führer. He was annoyed at being dragged so far from Tirpitz-Ufer at such a critical time. He thought, why can't he stay in Berlin like the rest of us? He's either buried in his Wolfschanze in Rustenburg or atop his Adler's Nest in Bavaria. Fogel had decided to make something good out of the trip. He planned to have dinner and spend the night with Gertrude and the girls. They were staying with Trude's mother in a village a two-hour drive from Berchtesgaden. God, how long had it been? One day at Christmas, 2 days in October before that. She had promised him a dinner of pork roast, potatoes, and cabbage, and, in that playful voice of hers, promised to do wonderful things to his body in front of the fire when the children and her parents had gone off to bed. Trude always liked to make love that way, somewhere insecure where they might be caught. Something about it always made it more exciting for her, the way it had been 20 years ago when he was a student at Leipzig. For Fogel, the excitement had gone out of it long ago. She had done it intentionally, as punishment for sending her to England.
Watch me, and remember this the next time you're with your wife.
Fogel thought, my God, why am I thinking of that now? He had managed to hide his feelings from Gertrude the way he had managed to hide everything else from her. He was not a born liar, but he had become a good one. Gertrude still believed he was a personal in-house counsel to Canaris. She had no idea he was the control officer of the Abwehr's most secret spy network in Britain. As usual, he had lied to her about what he was doing today. Trude believed he was in Bavaria on a routine errand for Canaris, not ascending Kehlstein Mountain to brief the Führer on the enemy's plans to invade France. Fogel feared she would leave him if she knew the truth. He had lied to her too many times, deceived her for too long. She would never trust him again. He often thought it would be easier to tell her about Anna than confess he had been a spymaster for Hitler. Canaris was feeding biscuits to the dogs. Fogel glanced at him, then looked away. Was it really possible? Was the man who had plucked him from the law and made him a top spy for the Abwehr a traitor? Canaris certainly made no attempt to conceal his disdain for the Nazis. His refusal to join the party, the constant stream of sarcastic remarks about Hitler. But had his disdain turned to treachery? If Canaris was a traitor, the consequences for the Abwehr networks in Britain were disastrous. Canaris was in a position to betray everything. Fogel thought, if Canaris is a traitor, why are most of the Abwehr networks in England still functioning? It didn't make sense. If Canaris had betrayed the networks, the British would have rolled them up overnight. The mere fact that the overwhelming majority of the German agents sent to England were still in place could be taken as proof that Canaris was not a traitor. Fogel's own network was theoretically immune from treachery. Under their arrangement, Canaris knew only the vaguest details of the V-chain. Fogel's agents did not cross paths with other agents. They had their own radio codes, rendezvous procedures, and separate lines of finance. And Fogel stayed clear of Hamburg, the control center for English networks. He remembered some of the idiots Canaris and the other control officers had sent to England, especially in the summer of 1940, when the invasion of Britain seemed at hand and Canaris threw all caution to the wind. His agents were poorly trained and poorly financed. Fogel knew some were given only £200, a pittance, because the Abwehr and the general staff believed Britain would fall as easily as had Poland and France. Most of the new agents were morons, like that idiot Karl Becker, a pervert, a glutton, in the espionage game only for the money and the adventure. Fogel wondered how a man like that managed to avoid capture. Fogel didn't like adventurers. He distrusted anyone who actually wanted to go behind enemy lines to work as a spy,
Only a fool would actually want to do that. And fools make bad agents. Fogel wanted only people who had the attributes and intelligence necessary to be a good spy. The rest of it, the motivation, the tradecraft, the willingness to use violence when necessary, he could provide. Outside, the temperature was dropping by degrees as they climbed higher along the winding Kehlsteinstrasse. The car's motor labored, tires skidding on the icy surface of the roadway. After a few moments, the driver stopped in front of the two huge bronze doors at the base of Kehlstein Mountain. A team of SS men carried out a rapid inspection, then opened the doors with the press of a single button. The car left the swirling snow of the Kehlsteinstrasse and entered a long tunnel. The marble walls shone in the light of the ornate bronze lanterns. Hitler's famous elevator awaited them. It was more like a small hotel room, with plush carpet, deep leather chairs, and a bank of telephones. Fogel and Canaris stepped in first. Canaris sat down and immediately lit a cigarette so that the elevator was filled with smoke when Himmler and Schellenberg arrived. The four men sat silently, each looking straight ahead, as the elevator whisked them toward the Obersalzberg, 6,000 feet above Berchtesgaden. Himmler, annoyed by the smoke, raised his gloved hand to his mouth and coughed gently. Fogel's ears popped with a rapid altitude change. He looked at the three men riding upward with him, the three most powerful intelligence officers in the Third Reich, a chicken farmer, a pervert, and a fussy little admiral who might very well be a traitor. In the hands of these men rested the future of Germany. Fogel thought, God help us all. The Nordic giant who served as the chief of Hitler's personal SS bodyguard showed them inside the salon. Fogel, normally indifferent to natural scenery, was stunned by the beauty of the panoramic view. Below, he could see the steeples and hills of Salzburg, the birthplace of Mozart. Near Salzburg was Untersberg, the mountain where Emperor Frederick Barbarossa awaited his legendary call to rise and restore the glory of Germany. The room itself was 50 feet by 60 feet, and by the time Fogel reached the seating area next to the fire, he was light-headed from the altitude. He settled down in the corner of a rustic couch while his eyes scanned the walls. Huge oil paintings and tapestries covered them. Fogel admired the Führer's collection, a nude believed to have been painted by Titian, a landscape by Spitzweg, Roman ruins by Panini. There was a bust of Wagner and a vast clock crowned by a bronze eagle. A steward silently poured coffee for the guests and tea for Hitler. The doors flew open a moment later and Adolf Hitler pounded into the room. Canaris, as usual, was the last one on his feet. The Führer gestured for them to return to their seats, then remained standing so he could pace. Captain Fogel, Hitler said without preamble. I understand your agent in London has scored another coup.
We believe so, my Führer.
Please, let's not keep it a secret any longer. Fogel, under the watchful gaze of an SS man, opened his briefcase.
Our agent has stolen another remarkable document. This document provides us further clues about the nature of Operation Mulberry.
Fogel hesitated.
We can now predict with much greater certainty just what role Mulberry will play in the invasion.
Hitler nodded. Please continue, Captain Fogel.
Based on the new documents, we believe Operation Mulberry is an anti-aircraft complex. It will be deployed along the French coastline in an effort to provide protection from the Luftwaffe during the critical first hours of the enemy invasion.
Fogel reached into his briefcase again.
Our analysts have used the designs in the enemy document to render a sketch of the complex.
Fogel laid it on the table. Schellenberg and Himmler both looked at it with interest. Hitler had walked away and stared out the windows toward his mountains. He believed he did his best thinking at the Berghof, where he was above it all.
And in your opinion, where will the enemy place this anti-aircraft complex, Captain Fogel?
The plans stolen by our agent do not specify where Mulberry will be deployed,
Fogel said.
But based on the rest of the intelligence collected by the Abwehr, it would be logical to conclude that Mulberry is destined for Calais.
And your old theory about an artificial harbor at Normandy?
It was...
Fogel hesitated, searching for the right word.
Premature, my Führer. I made a rush to judgment. I reached a verdict before all the evidence was in. I am a lawyer by training, my Führer, so you will forgive the metaphor.
No, Captain Fogel. I believe you were right the first time. I believe Mulberry is an artificial harbor, and I believe it is destined for Normandy. Hitler turned and faced his audience. This is just like Churchill, that madman! A grandiose, foolish contraption that betrays his intentions because it tells us where he and his American friends will strike. The man thinks of himself as a great thinker, a great strategist. But he is a fool when it comes to military matters. Just ask the ghosts of the boys he led to the slaughterhouse in the Dardanelles. No, Captain Fogel, you had it right the first time. It is an artificial harbor, and it is bound for Normandy. I know this! Hitler thumped his chest. Here!
Walter Schellenberg cleared his throat. My Führer, we do have other evidence to support Captain Fogel's intelligence.
Let's hear it, Herr Brigadeführer!
2 days ago, in Lisbon, I debriefed one of our agents in England. Fogel thought, oh Christ, here we go again. Schellenberg dug a document out of his briefcase. This is a memorandum written by an MI5 case officer named Alfred Vickery. It was approved by someone with the initials BB and forwarded to Churchill and Eisenhower. In it, Vickery warns that there is a new threat to security and that extra precautions should be taken until further notice. Vickery also warns that all Allied officers should be especially careful of approaches by women. Your agent in London... It's a woman, is it not, Captain Fogel?
Fogel said.
May I see that?
Schellenberg handed it to him. Hitler said,
Alfred Vickery! Why does that name sound familiar to me?
Canaris said,
Vickery is a personal friend of Churchill's. He was part of the group that had Churchill's ear during the 1930s. Churchill brought him to MI5 when he became Prime Minister in May 1940.
Yes, I remember now. Didn't he write a bunch of vile articles about National Socialism throughout the 30s?
Canaris thought, all of which turned out to be true. He said,
Yes, he's the one.
And who's BB?
Basil Boothby. He heads a division within MI5.
Hitler was pacing again, but slowly. The tranquility of the silent Alps always had a soothing effect on him.
Fogel, Schellenberg, and Canaris are all convinced. Well, I am not. An interesting turn of events, wouldn't you say, Herr Reichsführer?
The storm had moved off. Hitler was watching the sun vanishing in the west, the mountain peaks purple and pink with the high alpine dusk. Everyone had gone except Himmler.
First, Captain Fogel tells me Operation Mulberry is an artificial harbor, then it is an anti-aircraft complex.
Quite interesting, my Führer. I have my theories. Hitler turned away from the window.
Tell me!
Number one, he is telling the truth. He has received new information that he trusts, and he truly believes what he has told you.
Possible! Go on.
Number two, the intelligence he has just presented to you is totally fabricated, and Kurt Fogel, like his superior Wilhelm Canaris, is a traitor bent on the destruction of the Führer and of Germany. Hitler crossed his arms and tilted his head back.
Why would they deceive us about the invasion?
If the enemy succeeds in France and the German people see the war is lost, Canaris and the rest of the Schwarze Kapelle scum will turn on us and try to destroy us. If the conspirators succeed in grabbing power, they will sue for peace and Germany will end up the way she was after the First War, castrated, weak, the beggar of Europe, living off scraps from the tables of the British and the French and the Americans. Himmler paused. And the Bolsheviks, my Führer. Hitler's eyes seemed to catch fire. The very thought of Germans living under Russian domination, too painful to imagine.
We must never let that happen to Germany, he said,
then looked at Himmler carefully.
I see by that look on your face that you have another theory, Herr Reichsführer.
Yes, my Führer.
Let's hear it.
Fogel believes the information he is presenting to you is true, but he has been drinking from a poisoned well. Hitler seemed intrigued.
Go on, Herr Reichsführer.
My Führer, I have always been frank with you about my feelings for Admiral Canaris. I believe he is a traitor. I know he has had contact with British and American agents. If my fears about the Admiral are correct, wouldn't it be logical to assume he has compromised the German networks in Britain? Wouldn't it also be logical to assume that the information from Canaris's spies in England is also compromised? What if Captain Fogel actually discovered the truth, and Admiral Canaris silenced him in order to protect himself? Hitler was pacing restlessly again.
Brilliant, as usual, Herr Reichsführer. You are the only one I can trust.
Remember, my Führer, a lie is the truth, only backward. Hold the lie up to a mirror, and the truth will be staring back at you in the glass.
You have a plan. I can see it.
Yes, my Führer. And Kurt Fogel is the key. Fogel can bring us the secret of the invasion and proof of Canaris's treachery once and for all.
Fogel strikes me as an intelligent man.
He was considered one of the brightest legal minds in Germany before the war. But remember, he was recruited by Canaris personally. Therefore, I have my doubts about his loyalty. He will have to be handled very carefully.
That's your specialty, isn't it, Herr Reichsführer?
Himmler smiled his cadaverous smile. Yes, my Führer. The house was dark when Fogel arrived. A heavy snowstorm had stretched the two-hour drive to four. He stepped from the back of the car and collected his small grip from the trunk. He sent the driver on his way. He had booked a room for him at the small hotel in the village. Trude was standing in the open door, arms folded tightly against her body for warmth. She looked absurdly healthy, her fair skin pink with the cold, her brown hair streaked by the mountain sun. She wore a heavy ski sweater, wool trousers, and mountain boots. Despite the chunky clothing, Fogel could see she was fit from the outdoors. When Fogel took her into his arms, she said,
"My God, Kurt Fogel, you're nothing but a bag of bones. Are things so bad in Berlin?"
Everyone was in bed already. The girls shared a room upstairs. While Trude prepared his dinner, Fogel went up to look in on them. The room was cold. Nicole had climbed in bed with Lisbeth. In the darkness, it was hard to tell where one left off and the other began. He stood and he listened to their breathing and he smelled their scents, their breath, their hair, their soap, their warm bodies releasing the fragrance of the bedclothes. Trude always thought it was strange, but he loved the way they smelled more than anything else. A plate of food and a glass of wine awaited him downstairs. Trude had eaten hours ago, so she just sat next to him and talked while he devoured the roast pork and potatoes. He was surprisingly hungry. He finished the first plate and she filled a second, which he forced himself to eat more slowly. Trude talked about her parents and the girls, and how the Wehrmacht had come to the village and taken the remaining men and the schoolboys. She thanked God they had been given two daughters and no sons. She asked no questions about his trip, and he volunteered no details. He finished eating. Trude cleared away the dishes. She had made a pot of ersatz coffee and was standing at the stove, pouring him a cup, when there was a very faint tapping at the door. She crossed the room and opened the door, staring in disbelief at the figure, dressed all in black, standing before her.
"Oh, my God!"
she murmured as the cup and saucer fell from her grasp and shattered at her feet.
I still can't believe Heinrich Himmler actually set foot in this house,
Truda said, her voice flat, as though she was speaking to herself. She was standing before a weak fire in their bedroom, ramrod straight, arms folded. In the dim light, Fogel could see her face was damp and her body was trembling.
When I first saw that face, I thought I was dreaming. Then I thought we were all under arrest, and then it dawned on me. Heinrich Himmler was in my parents' house because he needed to confer with my husband.
She turned from the fire and looked at him.
Why is that, Kurt? Tell me you don't work for him. Tell me you're not one of Himmler's henchmen. Tell me, even if it's a lie.
I don't work for Heinrich Himmler.
Who was that other man?
His name is Walter Schellenberg.
What does he do?
Fogel told her.
What do you do? And don't tell me you're just Canaris' lawyer.
Before the war, I looked for very special people. I trained them and sent them to England to be spies.
Truda absorbed this information as if part of her had suspected it for a long time.
Why didn't you tell me this before?
I wasn't allowed to tell anyone, not even you. I deceived you in order to protect you. I had no other reason.
Where were you today?
It was no use lying to her any longer.
I was at Berchtesgaden for a meeting with the Führer.
God almighty,
she muttered, shaking her head.
What else have you lied to me about, Kurt Fogel?
I've lied to you about nothing else, only my work.
The look on her face said she didn't believe him.
Heinrich Himmler in this house. What happened to you, Kurt? You were going to be a great lawyer. You were going to be the next Hermann Heller. Maybe even sit on the Supreme Court. You loved the law.
There is no law in Germany, Truda. There is only Hitler.
What did Himmler want? Why did he come here so late at night?
He wants me to help him kill a friend.
I hope you said you won't help him.
Fogel looked up at her.
If I don't help him, he'll kill me. And then he'll kill you and he'll kill the girls. He'll kill us all, Truda.
Part 4. Chapter 43. London, February 1944.
Same thing as before, Alfred. She led the watchers on a merry chase for 3 hours, and then headed back to her flat.
Nonsense, Harry. She's meeting another agent, or she's making a dead drop somewhere.
If she did, then we missed it. Again.
Damn!
Vickery used the stub of his cigarette to light another. He was disgusted with himself. Smoking cigarettes was bad enough. Using one to light the next was intolerable. It was just the tension of the operation. It had entered its 3rd week. He had allowed Catherine Blake to photograph 4 batches of kettledrum documents. 4 times she had led the watchers on long chases around London, and 4 times they had failed to detect how she was getting the material out. Vickery was getting edgy. The longer the operation continued in this manner, the greater the chances of a mistake. The watchers were exhausted, and Peter Jordan was ready to revolt. Vickery said,
"Perhaps we're just going about this the wrong way."
"What do you mean?"
"We're following her, hoping we can detect her drop. What if we changed our tactics and started looking for the agent who's making the pickup?"
"But how? We don't know who he is or what he looks like."
"Actually, we might. Every time Catherine goes out, we go with her. And so does Ginger Bradshaw. He's taken dozens and dozens of photographs. Our man is bound to be in a couple of them."
"It's possible. Certainly worth a try."
Harry returned 10 minutes later with a stack of photographs 1 foot high.
150 photographs, to be exact, Alfred.
Vickery sat down at his desk and put on his half-moon reading glasses. He picked up the photographs 1 at a time and scanned the images for faces, clothing, suspicious looks, anything. Cursed with a near-photographic memory, Vickery stored each of the images in his mind and moved on to the next. Harry drank tea and paced quietly in the shadows. 2 hours later, Vickery thought he had a match.
"Look, Harry, here he is in Leicester Square, and here he is again outside Euston Station. Could be coincidence, could be two different people, but I doubt it."
"Well, I'm damned."
Harry studied the figure in the photographs. Small, dark-haired, with square shoulders and conventional clothing. Nothing about his appearance called attention to him. Perfect for pavement work. Vickery gathered up the remaining photographs and divided them in half.
"Start looking for him, Harry. Just him. No one else."
Half an hour later, Harry picked him out of a photograph taken on Trafalgar Square, which proved to be the best one yet.
"He needs a code name," Vickery said.
"He looks like a Rudolph."
"All right," Vickery said. "Rudolph it is."
Chapter 44. Hampton Sands, Norfolk. At that moment, Horst Neumann was pedalling his bicycle from Doherty's cottage toward the village. He wore his heavy roll-neck sweater, a reefer coat, and trousers tucked inside Wellington boots. It was a bright, clear day. Plump white clouds, driven by the strong northerly winds, drifted across a sky of deep blue. Their shadows raced across the meadows and the hillsides and disappeared over the beach. It was the last decent day they would see for a while. Heavy weather was forecast for the entire east coast of the country, beginning midday tomorrow and lasting several days. Neumann wanted to get out of the cottage for a few hours while he had the chance. He needed to think. The wind gusted, making it nearly impossible to keep the bicycle upright on the pitted single-lane track. Neumann put his head down and pedalled harder. He turned and looked over his shoulder. Doherty had given up. He had climbed off his bicycle and was pushing it morosely along the path. Neumann pretended not to notice and continued toward the village. He leaned forward over the handlebars, elbows thrust out, and cycled furiously up a small hill. He reached the top and coasted down the other side. The track was hard with the previous night's freeze, and the bicycle rattled along the deep ruts so viciously Neumann feared the front tire might break loose. The wind eased, and the village appeared. Neumann pedalled across the bridge over the Sea Creek and stopped on the other side. He laid the bicycle in the deep grass at the edge of the track and sat down next to it. He lifted his face toward the sun. It felt warm, despite the crisp air. A squadron of gulls circled silently overhead. He closed his eyes and listened to the beating of the sea. He was struck by an absurd notion. He would miss this little village when it was time to leave. He opened his eyes and spotted Doherty atop the hill. Doherty removed his cap, wiped his brow, and waved. Neumann called,
"Take your time, Sean!"
Then he gestured at the sun to explain why he was in no hurry to move. Doherty climbed back onto the bicycle and coasted down. Neumann watched Doherty. Then he turned and looked at the sea. The message he had received from Fogel early that morning troubled him. He had avoided thinking about it, but he could avoid it no longer. The wireless operator in Homburg had transmitted a code phrase that meant Neumann was to conduct counter-surveillance on Catherine Blake in London. Counter-surveillance, in the lexicon of the trade, meant he was supposed to follow Catherine to make certain she wasn't being followed by the opposition. The request could mean anything. It could mean that Fogel just wanted to make certain the information Catherine was receiving was good. Or it could mean he suspected she was being manipulated by the other side. If that was the case, Neumann might be walking straight into a very dangerous situation. If Catherine was under surveillance and he followed her too, he would be walking side by side with MI5 officers trained to recognize counter-surveillance. He would be walking right into a trap. He thought, "Damn you, Fogel, what are you playing at?" And what if she was being followed by the other side? Neumann had two choices. If possible, he was to contact Fogel by wireless and request authorization to extract Catherine Blake from England. If there was no time, he had Fogel's permission to act on his own. Doherty coasted across the bridge and stopped next to Neumann. A large cloud passed before the sun. Neumann shivered in the cold. He stood up and walked with Doherty toward the village, each man pushing his bicycle. The wind gusted, whistling through the crooked headstones in the graveyard. Neumann turned up the collar of his coat.
"Listen, Sean. There's a chance I may need to be leaving soon, in a hurry."
Doherty looked at Neumann, his face blank, then looked forward again. Neumann said,
"Tell me about the boat." "Early in the war, I was instructed by Berlin to create an escape route along the Lincolnshire coast, a way for an agent to get to a U-boat 10 miles offshore. His name is Jack Kincaid. He has a small fishing boat in the town of Cleethorpes, at the mouth of the River Humber. I've seen the boat. It's a bit of a wreck, otherwise it would have been seized by the Royal Navy, but it will do the trick."
"And Kincaid, what does he know?"
"He thinks I'm involved in the black market. Kincaid's into a lot of shady things, but I suspect he'd draw the line at working for the Abwehr. I paid him £100 and told him to be ready to do the job on short notice, any time, day or night."
"Contact him today," Neumann said. "Tell him we might be coming soon." Doherty nodded. Neumann said,
"I'm not supposed to make you this offer, but I'm going to anyway. I want you and Mary to consider coming out with me when I leave."
Doherty laughed to himself.
"And what am I supposed to do in bloody Berlin?"
"You'll be alive, for one thing," Neumann said. "We've left too many footprints, and the British aren't stupid, as much as you'd like to believe they are. They'll find you, and when they do, they'll march you straight to the gallows."
"I've thought of that already. A lot of good men have given their life for the cause. My brother did, and I'm not afraid to give mine."
"That's a lovely speech, Sean, but don't be a fool.
I'd say you bet on the wrong horse. You wouldn't be dying for the cause, you'd be dying because you engaged in espionage on behalf of the enemy, Nazi Germany. Hitler and his friends don't give a damn about Ireland, and helping them now isn't going to free Northern Ireland from English oppression. Not now, not ever. You understand me?"
Doherty said nothing.
"And there's something else you need to ask yourself. You may be willing to sacrifice your own life, but what about Mary's?"
Doherty looked up at him sharply.
"What do you mean?" "Mary knows you were spying for the Abwehr, and she knows I was an agent. If the British find out about that, they're not going to be happy, to say the least. She'll go to prison for a very long time, if she's lucky. If she's not lucky, they'll hang her, too."
Doherty waved his hand.
"They won't touch Mary. She didn't have any part in it."
"It's what they call being an accessory, Sean. Mary was an accessory to your espionage." Doherty walked in silence for a while, thinking over Neumann's words. Finally he said,
"What the hell would I do in Germany? I don't want to go to Germany."
"Fogel can arrange passage for you to a third country, Portugal or Spain. He might even be able to get you back into Ireland."
"Mary will never go. She'll never leave Hampton Sands. If I go with you, I'd have to go on my own. Leave her behind to face the bloody British."
They arrived at the Hampton Arms pub. Neumann leaned his bicycle against the wall, and Doherty did the same.
"Let me think about it tonight," Doherty said. "I'll talk to Mary and give you an answer in the morning."
They went inside the Arms, empty except for the publican, who was behind the bar polishing glasses. A large fire burned on the hearth. Neumann and Doherty removed their coats, hung them on a row of hooks next to the door, and sat down at the table nearest the fire. There was only one thing on the menu that day, pork pie. They ordered 2 pies and 2 glasses of beer. The fire was incredibly hot. Neumann removed his sweater. The publican brought the pies a few minutes later, and they ordered more beer. Neumann had helped Sean repair some fencing that morning, and he was starved. The only time Neumann looked up from his plate was when the door opened and a large man stepped inside. Neumann had seen him around the village and knew who he was. Jenny's father, Martin Colville. Colville ordered whiskey and stayed at the bar. Neumann, finishing the last of his pork pie, glanced up at him at regular intervals. He was a large, powerful man with black hair that fell into his eyes and a black beard flecked with grey. His coat was filthy and smelled of motor oil. His huge hands were cracked and permanently soiled. Colville drank the first whiskey in one gulp and ordered a second. Neumann ate the last of his pie and lit a cigarette. Colville finished the second whiskey and glared in Neumann and Doherty's direction.
"I want you to stay away from my daughter," Colville said. "I hear you two have been seen together around the village, and I'm not happy about it."
Doherty, through clenched teeth, said,
"Stay out of it, mate."
"Jenny and I spend time together because we're friends," Neumann said. "Nothing more."
"You expect me to believe that? You want to get under a skirt? Well, Jenny's not that kind of girl."
"Frankly, I don't give a damn what you believe."
"I put up with her hanging around Paddy here and his wife. But I won't put up with the likes of you. You're no good for her. And if I ever hear about you two being together again..."
Colville thrust out his forefinger at Neumann.
"I'll be coming after you."
Doherty said, "Just nod and smile and be done with it. She spends time with Sean and Mary because they care about her. They give her a pleasant, safe home, which is more than I can say for you."
"Jenny's home is none of your affair. Just keep your nose out of it. And if you know what's good for you, you'll stay the fuck away from her."
Neumann crushed out his cigarette. Doherty was right. He should just sit there and keep his mouth shut. The last thing he needed now was to provoke a fight with a villager. He looked up at Colville. He knew the type. The bastard had terrorized everyone his entire life, including his own daughter. Neumann relished the opportunity to put him in his place. He thought, if I show him what it's like, maybe he'll never hurt Jenny again. He said,
"What are you going to do? Hit me? That's your answer for everything, isn't it? Whenever something happens that you don't like, you just hit someone. That's why Jenny spends so much time with the Dohertys. That's why she can't stand to be around you."
Colville's face tightened. He said,
"Who the fuck are you? I don't believe your story."
He crossed the pub in a few quick steps, took hold of the table, and threw it out of the way.
"You're mine, and I'm going to enjoy this."
Neumann got to his feet. "Lucky me." A small knot of villagers, sensing trouble, gathered outside the pub around the two men. Colville threw a wild right hook that Neumann avoided easily. Colville threw two more punches. Neumann avoided them by moving his head just a few inches, keeping his hands protectively around his face and his eyes locked on Colville's, staying back on the defensive. If he tried to move close enough to land a punch, Colville might be able to grab him with his powerful arms, and he might never get away again. He had to wait for Colville to make a mistake. Then he would go on the offensive and end this thing as quickly as possible. Colville threw several more wild punches. He was already out of breath and laboring. Neumann could see frustration building in his face. Colville reached out his arms and charged like a bull. Neumann stepped quickly to the side and tripped Colville as he stormed past. He landed face down with a heavy thud. Neumann moved in quickly as Colville was rising to his hands and knees and kicked him twice rapidly in the face. Colville raised a heavy forearm, absorbing a third blow, and scrambled back onto his feet. Neumann had managed to break his nose. Blood streamed from both nostrils into his mouth. Neumann said,
"You've had enough, Martin. Let's stop this and go back inside."
Colville said nothing. He stepped forward, jabbed with his left hand, and unleashed a powerful roundhouse right. The blow landed high on Neumann's cheekbone, splitting the flesh. Neumann felt as if he'd been hit by a sledgehammer. His head rang, tears flowed into his eyes, his vision blurred. He shook his head to clear the cobwebs and thought of Paris, lying in the filthy alley behind the café, his own blood running into the puddles of rainwater, the SS men above him, kicking him with their jackboots, beating him with their fists, their pistol butts, wine bottles, anything. Colville unleashed another reckless punch. Neumann crouched, then pivoted and kicked sideways, landing a savage blow on Colville's right kneecap. The bigger man screamed in agony.
Neumann rapidly kicked him 3 more times. Colville was crippled. Neumann wondered if he had dislodged the kneecap. Colville was also terrified. He had obviously never encountered anyone who fought like Neumann. Neumann kept moving to his right, forcing Colville to put weight on his damaged leg. Colville could barely remain standing. Neumann thought his opponent was finished. When Neumann's back was toward the pub, Colville shifted all his weight to his good leg and lunged. Neumann, surprised, couldn't get out of the way fast enough. Colville smashed into him and drove him back against the wall. It was like being hit by a speeding lorry. Neumann struggled to regain his breath. Colville raised his head viciously, catching Neumann beneath his chin. Neumann bit his own tongue and blood poured into his mouth. Before Colville could strike again, Neumann raised the knee into his groin. Colville doubled over, groaning deep in his throat. Neumann raised his knee again, this time into Colville's face, shattering bone. Neumann stepped forward, raised his arm, and drove his elbow downward into the side of Colville's head. Colville's knees buckled and he collapsed, barely conscious. Neumann said, "Don't get up, Martin. If you know what's good for you, stay right where you are." Then Neumann heard screaming. He looked up and saw Jenny running toward him. That night, Neumann lay awake in his bed. He had slept for a while, but the pain had awakened him. Now he lay very still, listening to the wind beating against the side of the cottage. In the distance, he could hear the rush of the waves against the shoreline. He did not know the time. His wristwatch was lying on the little table next to the bed. He rose onto one elbow, reached out for it, groaning with pain, and looked at the luminous face. Nearly midnight. He fell back onto his pillow and stared at the ceiling. Fighting with Martin Colville was a foolish mistake. He had endangered his cover and the security of the operation, and he had hurt Jenny. Outside the pub, she had screamed at him and beat her fists against his chest. She was furious with him for hurting her father. He had just wanted to teach the bastard a lesson, but it had all backfired. Now, lying in bed, listening to the confused rhythm of the ceaseless wind, he wondered whether the entire operation was doomed. He thought of Catherine's warning on Hampstead Heath. "Some things have gone wrong. I don't think my cover is going to hold up much longer." He thought of Fogel's order to conduct counter-surveillance. He wondered whether all of them, Fogel, Catherine, himself, had already made fatal mistakes. Neumann took stock of his injuries. He seemed to hurt everywhere. His ribs were bruised and tender. Every breath hurt. But it appeared he had suffered no broken bones. His tongue was swollen, and when he rubbed it along the roof of his mouth, he felt the cut on the surface. He raised his hand and touched his cheek. Mary had done her best to close the wound without stitches. Going to a doctor was out of the question. He checked to make certain the dressing was securely in place. Even the lightest touch made his face pound with pain. Neumann closed his eyes and tried to sleep. He was beginning to drift off when he heard a footfall on the landing outside his door. Instinctively, he reached for his Mauser. He heard another footfall, then the floor creaking beneath the weight of a body. He raised the Mauser and leveled it at the door. He heard the rattle of someone turning the latch. He thought, if MI5 was coming for me, they certainly wouldn't be trying to sneak into my bedroom at night. But if it wasn't MI5 or the police, who the hell was it? The door pushed back and a small figure stood in the open space. Neumann, in the dim light of his open shade, could see it was Jenny Colville. He quietly laid the Mauser on the floor next to the bed and whispered, "What do you think you're doing?" "We came to see if you were all right." "Do Sean and Mary know you're here?" "No, we let myself in." She sat down on the edge of the small bed. "How are you feeling?"
"I've been through worse. Your father packs quite a punch. But then you know that better than anyone else."
She reached out in the darkness and touched his face.
"You should have seen a doctor. That was quite a cut on your face."
"Mary did an excellent job." Jenny smiled.
"She's had a lot of practice with Sean. She said that when Sean was young, Saturday night wasn't Saturday night unless it ended with a good fight outside the pub."
"How's your father?" "I think I hit him one too many times."
"He'll be all right. Oh, his face is a mess. He was never very good-looking to begin with.
I'm sorry, Jenny. The whole thing was ridiculous. I should have known better. I should have just ignored him.
The publican said my father started it. He deserved what he got. He's had it coming for a long time.
You're not angry with me anymore?
No. No one's ever stood up for me before. That was a very brave thing you did. My father is as strong as an ox. He could have killed you.
She removed her hand from his face and ran it across his chest.
Where did you learn to fight like that?
In the army.
It was terrifying. My God, but your body is covered with scars.
I've lived a very rich and fulfilling life. She came closer to him.
Who are you, James Porter? And what are you doing in Hampton Sands?
I came here to protect you.
Are you my knight in shining armor?
Something like that. Jenny stood up abruptly and pulled her sweater over her head.
Jenny, what do you think you're... Shh! You'll wake Mary. You can't stay here. It's after midnight. You wouldn't send me out into a night like this, would you?
Jenny had removed her Wellington boots and her trousers before he could answer the question. She climbed into bed and curled up next to him, beneath his arm. Neumann said,
"If Mary finds you here, she'll kill me." "You're not afraid of Mary, are you?"
"Your father I can handle, but Mary's another story altogether."
She kissed him on the cheek and said,
"Good night."
After a few minutes, her breathing assumed the rhythm of sleep. Neumann leaned his head against hers, listening to the wind, and after a few moments he slept too. Chapter 45. Berlin. The Lancasters came at 2 o'clock in the morning. Fogel, sleeping fitfully on the army cot in his office, rose and went to the window. Berlin shuddered beneath the impact of the bombs. He parted the blackout curtain and looked out. The car was still there, a large black sedan, parked across the street. It had been there all night and all afternoon before that. Fogel knew there were at least 3 men inside, because he could see the embers of their cigarettes glowing in the dark. He knew the engine was running, because he could see the exhaust drifting from the tailpipe into the freezing night air. The professional in him marveled at the shoddiness of their surveillance. Smoking, knowing full well the embers would be visible in the dark, running the engine so they could have heat, even though the worst amateur could spot the exhaust. But then the Gestapo didn't need to worry much about technique and tradecraft. They relied on terror and brute force. Hammer blows. Fogel thought about his conversation with Himmler at the house in Bavaria. He had to admit Himmler's theory made a certain amount of sense. The fact that most of the German intelligence networks in Britain were still operational was not proof of Canaris's loyalty to the Führer. It was proof of the opposite, his treachery. If the head of the Abwehr is a traitor, why bother to publicly arrest and hang his spies in Britain? Why not use those spies, and, together with Canaris, try to fool the Führer with false and misleading intelligence? Fogel thought it was a plausible scenario. But a deception of that magnitude was almost unimaginable. Every German agent would have to be in custody or turned by the other side. Hundreds of British case officers would have to be involved in the project, turning out reams of false intelligence reports to be transmitted by wireless back to Hamburg. Could there be such a deception? It would be a mammoth and risky undertaking, but Fogel concluded it was possible. The concept was brilliant, but Fogel recognized one glaring weakness. It required total manipulation of the German networks in Britain. Every agent had to be accounted for, turned or locked away where they could do no harm. If there was a single agent outside MI5's web of control, that one agent could file a contradictory report and the Abwehr might smell a rat. It could use the reports from the one genuine agent to conclude that all the other intelligence it was receiving was bogus. And if all the other intelligence was pointing toward Calais as the invasion point, the Abwehr could conclude that in fact the opposite was true. The enemy was coming at Normandy. He would have his answer soon. If Neumann discovered that Catherine Blake was under surveillance, Fogel could dismiss the information she was sending as smoke concocted by British intelligence, part of a deception. He turned from the window and lay on his army cot. A chill ran down him. He might very well uncover evidence that British intelligence was engaged in a grand deception, and that in turn would strongly suggest that Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, the head of German military intelligence, was a traitor. Himmler would certainly take it as ironclad proof. There was only one punishment for such an offence, piano wire around the neck, a slow, torturous death by strangulation, all captured on film so Hitler could watch it over and over again. And what if he did uncover proof of a deception? The Wehrmacht would be waiting with their panzers at the invasion point. The enemy would be slaughtered. Germany would win the war, and the Nazis would rule Germany and Europe for decades.
There is no law in Germany, Trude. There is only Hitler.
Vogel closed his eyes and tried to sleep, but it was no good. The two incompatible aspects of his personality were in full conflict. Vogel the spymaster and manipulator, and Vogel the believer in the rule of law. He was tantalized by the prospect of uncovering a massive British deception, of outwitting his British opponents, of destroying their little game. At the same time, he was terrified by what that victory would bring. Prove a British deception, destroy his old friend Canaris, win the war for Germany, secure the Nazis in power forever. He lay on his cot awake, listening to the rumble of the bombers.
Tell me you don't work for him, Kurt.
Vogel thought, I do now, Trude. I do now.